Welcome back, everybody, to Hoops HD. What are we going here? Hollywood Square style, Brady Bunch style. It has been a while. We're here July 22nd. It's been a couple months since we last spoke to you. We didn't completely
We
forget
didn't do
about
a
it,
show in June. I was in jail.
well,
I can
as
confirm, and I will explain later.
okay. Anyhow, I'm your host, Chad Sherwood, up here in the top center. Up next to me up here are David Griggs and David Dorman. Center square below me, Joby Fortson. His sides, John Stalica and John Tytel. Down in the bottom row there, joining us from Bracketeer.org, Rocco Miller as well. So we've got a lot of people on the show here, and we don't really have a real plan here for the show. And then we just kind of go over generally what's been going on in college, in the college basketball world for the last couple of months in the off season here. It's what happened most recently, Griggs? The
Well, the
championship
committee
game.
made.
UConn won the championship. Is that what happened last?
Well, that was last year. That was the
Okay.
23-24 athletic year. We're way past that now. UConn is no longer the champions. Sorry, Zach. But the committee made their recommendations, and one of them, they looked at it. They looked at going to 72, 76, or 80, and they decided it just wasn't. I don't know if it was too difficult logistically, or if they just decided it was better the way it was. I think both are true, but we're sticking at 68. But there are some changes. I know we're going to get into that. Nothing really that, unless you're just sort of like a complete basketball nerd, that you would even really notice. I think what wasn't one of the changes is that schools can play at their host site now, or I know that's being discussed.
Well, the biggest changes last about in terms of the NCAA tournament selection and bracketology, and a lot of us here are bracketologists. Bad ones like Griggs, good ones like Tytel and Rocco.
Not that bad. I mean,
but
just because I never get it right doesn't mean I'm bad.
well, putting D3 schools in your field is not very good, Griggs. But
That team won a lot of games.
they did announce, actually, those of you who were watching the show last year, we pull up our standings and our team sheets during the course of the season. And one of the columns we'd always had was for the Sagarin ratings, and we were following them in the past because that was on the official NCAA team sheets that the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee reviews every year. Sagarin stopped doing ratings last year, and in order to fill in that blank line, I said, well, let's put the Torvik ratings up there, the T rankings on the screen, because I know a lot of people really follow him. He's a really good ranking. Well, clearly, because the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee watches this
It
show,
watches this
they
show,
decide to make
yes.
that official. Joby, you're our ratings guy, so let me start with you here. Beginning with this season, the official NCAA team sheets will be following the two ratings that Torvik releases, both his T rank, which is a predictive metric, and his WAB or his WOB rank. So we're going to be talking about WOBs for the next 10
Oh,
years,
great. Wobs. Now we got wobs.
which is a resume-based metric that he does.
And then he also has, what's funny is I'll start off with this. He has a third rank that is actually one that does exactly what the JNG does, which is try to predict through numbers the tournament field seed list. And it is actually pretty good. One year, while the JNG, as you know, in 8 of its 9 years of existence, has finished first, one of those years it was tied with Torvik's. So his is a, and that was just 2 or 3 years ago.
Is there anything more circular than that? The committee having a ranking on its sheet that guesses the committee?
I
Well,
wouldn't
they're not
mind.
putting that one on the sheet Griggs. That's a different one
Yeah,
that's not
that will
going on the
not be
sheet.
on the sheet, but it shows you the numbers that he's into it. It's nice to have. I'll be interested to see how they do deal with the two rankings because, as we know, predictive takes, I mean, basically, in the simplistic terms, predictive is going to really look at margin of victory or margin of possession, per possession
Margin
and
of victory.
turnover.
Yeah, it will.
But it's margin of victory, whereas the WOB will look more at the strength of schedule, how the teams performed, and
The
less at
wob.
margin and not at margin of victory. So it'll be interesting. They losing Sagarin was more of a margin of victory type, though not to the purest sense like KenPom or even the NCAA net, I dare say. But it'll be very interesting how they have with those two, because the SOR, which is also on the sheet, is very resume centric. It'll be interesting if we'll see the
It's
correlation between
entirely
them.
resume centric.
Yes, entirely. And so it'll be very interesting. I don't know if it'll have huge effect, but it's something to keep in mind. If all of a sudden we see correlations coming through, then yeah, at least it's in the room though. But I think KenPom, of the outside ratings from the net, I think KenPom is still the one to watch for the very simple reason that the net's correlation is closest to KenPom because of the, if they really like that efficiency. I wish they would be honest, to be honest, I wish they would clean up the net because it leads to abuse in scheduling. There was all the talk of the Big 12 and the Mountain West, and also abuse within games. You don't pull your starters because a 50-point win looks really good, in KenPom. BYU had a very high net last year. One of the reasons in KenPom, one of the reasons is because they're beating the bad teams they played. They're beating by 50 and 60 points. And so it was, and not, hey, BYU was a good team last year, but they weren't the fourth best team in the country. I think we all can agree. So
Yeah, and the committee agreed
I'd
too.
like to see some adjustments, maybe a cap of some sort, on because when people start playing to a rating, then you play, then you change the way you coach and handle a game. And if one of those changes means less sportsmanship, for lack of a better word, less enjoyment for the fans, then yeah, we probably need to tweak it. Not wholesale change it, but tweak the ratings so that people don't play to that in the same manner.
Let me throw this over here to our two bracketologists. Marco, let me start with you. Bart Torvik's ratings, by the way, that's at his website, barttorvik.com, if anyone wants to check those out. Have you used them in the past? And are they something that you think you're going to start looking at in the future when you're evaluating teams a lot more now that these two numbers are on the team sheets?
Well, I think it's a good tool, especially in the off season. Right now, you're able to pull up 2025 projections. His data isn't 100% accurate for next year's rosters. It's really hard to track all 364, coming Division I teams and their roster changes. But he's done a really good job with that. And I think in scheduling, just being kind of behind the scenes there, you see kind of your first line of defense is going to Torvik's site. It's something you could be on the phone with another coach talking about a potential game and saying, all right, who do you like better next year, Austin Peay or Eastern Michigan? And we're like, all right, well,
Austin
let's
Peay.
go to, there you go. But in scheduling, it's the opposite. You want to play the weaker team, so you would pick Eastern Michigan.
I'd still pick the better team. Yeah.
So I've been really familiar with it through that lens. Now, once the season starts, I've really crafted everything I do around what the committee cares about, what the committee has access to, and anything that they might look at or might subjectively have access to, I rule it out because it's not a congruent tool. Now it will be a congruent tool across all 12 selection committee members. And I think in general, it's a good thing because, like you mentioned, Chad, last year we had two on each side of the spectrum. We had two tools for resume based. And two tools for predictive base. Now there'll be three on each side, with the net kind of being the de facto source of truth in the middle of those six. And I think the one thing that I've had the biggest concern about over the last handful of years is the BPI through ESPN. And so by throwing the Torvik in there, which I believe is a lot more similar to KenPom, probably more similar to the net as well. It'll be easier now when you have those crazy BPI outliers. We've seen it from several Mountain West teams, but also teams like Creighton and a couple of Big East teams here and there, and others that are not in ESPN contracted television rights agreements. Now those conspiracies, they will still exist, but if you have two tools telling you one thing and only one telling you the other, you can kind of call that third one an outlier within a given team. And I think the same holds true when you look at the resume metrics. I think the wins above bubble is actually a potential helper for the non-power programs. I also think because it's based on the degree of difficulty for wins above bubble is based on net. So that's going to favor the power programs based on the fact that power programs are all at the top of the net for the most part. If you look at the Big Ten and the SEC are going to be the power two, right, going forward. I think that's going to start taking over in basketball. If you look at this year's projections, all 34 of those schools are in the top 74 projected for next year. It's pretty ridiculous how much power they've consolidated. But I think it's going to help the underdog a little bit. If you go back and do the work last year, wins above bubble metric would have helped Indiana State tremendously. It would have actually gotten Princeton a much closer look as Wins Above Bubble had them as a safe team in. It also would have helped a couple of Mountain West teams in both Utah State and Nevada. James Madison probably would have been above the bubble. Dayton would have been much higher. And so I think the only power team that would have benefited in all those cases was South Carolina, who, you know, they just happened to get blown out by a few teams like Alabama and Kentucky, but also had some incredibly great road wins. Who cares if it was by 1 or 3 points? They got those wins. And so for all those reasons, I think Wins Above Bubble is a big help.
I love that metric. Anyway, I know you're going to someone other than me.
It's the WAB. And Tytel, you are the bracketologist on here. And you know, is this a metric? Is this a you know? Are you bookmarking Bartorvik's site and really start doing an in-depth analysis into what this wins above bubble, not wins against bubble, wins above bubble? I kind of equate it to, you hear about wins above replacement in baseball. It's almost that type of stat for you know, the baseball war, the basketball wob, and these numbers.
Well, I mean, Chad, I only ranked 7th out of 179 entries in the bracket matrix.
Exactly. You've got to get paid. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not very good.
Not at all. So I certainly need to incorporate Wab and Torvik into my rankings and brackets this year. I'm excited about Torvik, actually less so for the ranking part of it, as I've heard it's very similar to KenPom, but as I often try to predict who's the best player in each conference and things like that, I hear that he has a all-in-one offensive stat involving points over replacement per adjusted game at that usage. So I'm going to have to incorporate the word "porpagatu" into my vocabulary very soon. And then as far as the WAB, I like that it's about scheduling. It's not just do I have more wins than a bubble team. It's how many more wins do I have that a bubble team would have earned using my schedule, the same schedule. So I think that that will be a very accurate metric that I will definitely incorporate.
Yeah, I was taking a quick look at last year's WAB or wins against bubble. Indiana State, the best team that was left out, the highest ranked WAB at
Yes.
28 in the WAB would have been not only in but in the top half of the bracket had they gone based on that type of number.
Yeah.
Let me get a few other thoughts here real quick, and then we'll go to some. But Dorman, any thoughts on these changes?
I'm actually going to compliment the NCAA for once. I think it's actually very forward-looking to incorporate the Torvik. One, they haven't been around that long of a time, and I think it's a great analytic tool. He does great stuff on the website. You can pull down different groups, different categories. And like someone already discussed, Tytel said the wins above the bubble to me is huge. On our sheets, Chad, you've had wins versus the board on our sheets for a long time, and that's a big number to me. That shows you how the under the radar conferences can do against the big power boys in the conference tournament setting. And why I also like Torvik, I just think he puts a lot of offense and defensive metrics in that the committee hasn't really seen before. And his website is really, it's actually fun to use, and you can play around with it versus like Sagarin and stuff. There was nothing to play around with. You couldn't look at the numbers in different ways or put teams in groups. It's a great site. I think Torvik does a great job. I think the NCAA made a great call by incorporating this tool.
Yeah, really, it's a fun site to play with too. It's all stats. That's all it really is. There's not no other filler in there, and you can there's filters that you could sort things by any way you want, pretty much. So it's definitely you can sit there and play this site for half an hour.
College basketball
I will say
hours.
One thing.
College basketball geeks will love it. It's a fun tool to play with forever.
I will
Sort of
say
like
though, if
HHT.
the underlying ranking that goes wins above bubble floats to a KenPom in the NCAA tournament last year was wildly bad at predicting because I hate to be sorry, we're going to bang the drum. We're on a podcast, so I got to rag on the Mountain West. Mountain West teams once again did not perform, and the reason why is because of the inflated metric off net slash KenPom. If Torvik falls into that same category. I'm not blaming Indiana State or something like that, but if it falls into that same category of inflation and the bubble in question is inflated, then that could turn into a, just as I believe KenPom got abused, this could get abused real quick and unfortunately could cause more problems. I'm not saying it will. I'm very hopeful because I love the concept. As you point out, our own team sheets that Chad puts together are excellent and try to address a lot of these same things. So I'm very happy the NCAA is trying it. I'm just putting a cautionary tale in case things come down the line.
Okay. Stepping away from math class at least a little bit here, I like that they made these changes, and I like that based on what Chad said, which is true, that it's going to change how a lot of the maybe under the radar or non-power teams get looked at. What I am curious about is who sort of pushed for this, and if I guess what I'm asking or wondering.
That's easy, Griggs. They watched our podcast. They watched our tournament rankings, and they took it. I mean, come on.
Yeah, they watched it. But it's like, okay, if you felt that Indiana State wasn't valued correctly, then why didn't they value them differently? 10 members are still on this year's committee where they're last year. Anyway,
we have a big lot of new members this year. I believe there's five new members this year out of 12 members. So that is a significant change over.
You're right.
Which I think could be very interesting also as we head into next season, because that's almost half the committee is people with who may value teams differently than the old committee members did.
Yeah, but I like that they made the changes. I guess it's just there was no indication that they were leaning in this direction when you looked at who's been selected, especially last year, and who wasn't. And it's almost outrageous to me that James Madison, while they didn't need the at-large bid, was seated below the first four. Like, what in the hell is wrong with you?
let's move on here. And Tytel, I want to throw it back over to you. I think maybe first to start, this was one of your topics that you want to discuss tonight. You want to talk about transfers, or maybe a few of you want to discuss this. But there are, you know, we're in a new age of the transfer portal. Obviously, I don't even know who's on what roster at the moment, quite honestly. We've been seeing offseason here so far.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally 1,000 that we could discuss. I'm going to try to limit it to 3 guys who went from mid-majors to high majors and I think will make an impact. Number one, Trey Townsend moving from Oakland to Arizona.
Absolutely.
He was the Verizon Player of the Year and Conference Tourney MVP last March. He had a pair of double-doubles last March in wins over Kentucky and a loss to NC State in the tournament. Number two, Zeke Mayo, who's transferring from South Dakota State to Kansas. He was the Summit League Player of the Year. And in the past 2 years, he's averaged 19.6 boards, 4 assists, while shooting 38% from behind the arc and 86% at the free throw line. Number three, Amari Williams, moving from Drexel to Kentucky. 3-time CAA Defensive Player of the Year. And over the past 2 years, 13 points, 8 boards, 2 blocks, shooting 52% from the field. I think those three guys not only can start, but make a big impact for Arizona, Kansas, and Kentucky.
Yes.
Anyone else? Feel free to jump in. if not, we can move. I know, Sliga, you also want to talk about some media deals, related, some issues related to the Big East, and maybe your Xavier Musketeers at a charity game as well.
Well, first of all, the Big East media deal, the current one is going to be expiring after the 2024-25 season. So that's going to be the end of a 12-year media deal. So what's going to happen now is they're going to start having games that are, in addition to being played on FS1 and Fox, they're no longer going to be on the CBS brand of networks, but now they're going to be shifting some of the Big East tournament games along with some regular season games over to Peacock starting in the 2024-25 season. And then starting in 2025-26, they're also going to have games that are going to be on the TNT, TBS, and True TV family. How many of those games could still be up in the air, because we don't know exactly how many games the NBA is going to have on their TNT package. But my gut feeling is that's probably going to be down considerably from where they've been in the past. I know Dorman is telling me it's going to be 0.
Correct.
I think that's still up in the air. Of course, it also does beg the question. The Big Ten last year started playing some of their games on Peacock, so we're probably going to be seeing a situation where the Big Ten, the Big 12, and the Big East, the Mountain West, are all going to be sharing games on FS1, and the Big East can start making a niche for itself on Peacock, along with the TBS and TNT families.
Yeah, well, Dorman, I think just this more Peacock here. We had the Big Ten now, Big East. I think we're moving more and more to the days where, we're going to see the Amazons coming into play here as well, and all these other services, and moving away from the cable TV slash ESPN model and into this newer model, I think.
Unfortunately, I'm with you, Chad, and I agree with everything Stalika just said. I just like to have the clicker in my hand. I like to go to channel, and make it on regular, cable TV. The streaming to go in and out of different streams and how far back and behind it is just. I don't. I like watching the game on the TV with the clicker in my hand. I know that's old school, but. The way of the future is going to be all these, different sites like Apple and Amazon fighting it out for different packages. And we're already seeing it in football at the highest level. So it's the way of the future. Get ready.
And Chad, it will also change the way the value of teams from conferences are. Right now, it is very geographically run. So if the ACC, for instance, which is often talked about from a football standpoint, were to break up, actually, the most valuable two teams right now are North Carolina and Virginia. North Carolina doesn't
That's
have a
because
parent.
that's because nobody wants Florida State.
Well, but here's the thing.
We've heard that come out from several conferences, but go ahead. I'm sorry
You
to
would think
interrupt.
that Florida State and Clemson would be the most valuable teams because of their performance on the field in football, which is the revenue driver. But in reality, it's about geography. It's about getting views and little old ladies who won't watch a minute of Big Ten basketball on the Big Ten network or SEC football on the SEC network. It's about they would now have to pay in Roanoke, Virginia, an untapped market, or Raleigh, North Carolina. They would have to pay 50 cents per subscriber as opposed to 10 cents. That is a huge benefit. As cable becomes less, it will then turn into, okay, how many impressions can you get on Peacock? How many impressions on Amazon? That will change. All of a sudden, well, more people want to watch Clemson football than they want to watch North Carolina or Virginia football. And so it will change the value of particular teams, which will be very acute with the looming grant of rights expiration in, a few years in the ACC, which I think will lead to a wholesale change in that conference. Not that Stanford, Cal, and SMU jointly didn't already do that.
And we're gonna get to realignment here in a second, but first, Rocco, I want to go back to you. We're also seeing a lot. I know you're very into the scheduling, into a lot of the preseason tournaments. We're seeing a lot of new tournaments popping up and a lot of change over in the tournaments. I know we've discussed this with you a couple months ago, but anything that you've seen the last few months that's really standing out here?
I mean, nothing specifically. I think it's wait and see at the top with the NIL festival in Vegas with these eight teams that are all scheduled to go at this point. Some of the dates and matchups have actually already been announced, at least for the first couple of games. Two different pods will be played, and then what remains to be seen is what happens with their third game. But the more important factor, what remains to be seen, is if they're able to profit off this or not, which is a huge mystery. It's guaranteed to fork out at least $10 million, $1 million per team, and then an extra million for the winning team on each pod. So they are giving out 10 million there, and they are also planning to give out 16 spots for next year's event. And I think if it goes well, the eight you see this year are all planning to coming back, except for maybe Oregon, who I know is still tied to Maui as of now. But I think the majority of the eight are all planning to come back if it goes well. But the real mystery is behind the money behind it, which we all know is now tied to some of the Gulf states in the Middle East and some of the oil money out there. And it's really kind of a larger picture on American sports as a whole, as you've seen in golf and in race car racing and other sports. And so basically somebody globally is looking at college basketball as a very undervalued product, and they're willing to take this risk with this first kind of experiment. And if they're right, if they start to be able to prove a profit on it and get a bigger audience, it's going to change the sport in a lot of different dramatic ways. And it's going to prove a lot of people betting against them wrong. Now, with that said, the other side of it is I'm talking to all these traditional event organizers, even some recent successful ones. I'm talking to the guy who's running three different tournaments down in Palm Springs. I think there's actually 20 teams going there now. And I'm also talking to the, you know, your Gazelle groups and all those types of companies that run events every year and know the model well, and they've mastered it over several seasons.
Oh, the Gazelle group has mastered the CBI anyway.
They have. Yeah. Yes, because if you play in the CBI, you get an MTE next year. And then,
that's a pretty nice. You get a weekend at Daytona and all.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I do want to jump in for a moment.
Let me, Rocco, finish his thought. Then go to sleep. Let me go back over to you.
Yeah. So there are a lot of those folks, you know, not naming any names specifically. I was just giving you a couple examples there. They think it's ludicrous and they won't be able to turn a profit and they'll be out of the game in a year. So it's going to be fascinating to see it play out, you know, from my lens, being a neutral third party there.
Rocco, okay, if you had to guess.
Salika, wait, what, let me get Salika's thought, then I'll go to you, Greg. So let's one at a time.
I was asking Rocco a question.
Okay, I do want to mention for that tournament that Rocco just mentioned, Creighton was initially slated to be in the battle for Atlantis. If you told me about 18 months ago that they would want to get out of that one in exchange for this tournament, I'd have thought you were smoking something with the puppet, but when you consider how the landscape is changing, there's a reason why Creighton is pulled out of such an event.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a perfect example, because for Creighton to get out of the battle for Atlantis, it was at least 100,000. Some have said 200,000 for them to get out, but they looked at it as, and again, Creighton's one of those programs, I think everybody here realizes this, they're at the forefront of the NIL era. I was kind of blown away when I went to their home game last February against Marquette. You walk around the concourse, they're selling everything you can think of with players' names on it. I've seen games in every league. I have not seen NIL done to the level of Creighton's fan engagement. You'll see little kids wearing Kalkbrenner jerseys and the whole nine yards. So Creighton is really embracing this opportunity to be at the forefront, and obviously anything they can do for their players, the opportunity to get up to $1 million in revenue share or higher, they'll pay that $200,000 penalty to do it. So that's what's been most fascinating, because like you said, Stalika, Battle for Atlantis and Maui for the last decade or more have been the premier events with the best fields. If you get your program into that field, you've got your program at its peak. And now that there's something even more desirable, has really shaken up the whole preseason tournament game. And it's had a huge domino effect.
Yeah. Real quick, I'm just curious to get your thoughts. Dumping $10 million into one MTE early season college basketball event does sound kind of nuts, at least to me. It's not going to get 10 million viewers. Almost nothing does outside of NCAA tournament games. What do you think? Is this? I know we've had this discussion before off air, me, you, and Galen too. It sounds ludicrous to me. But does it make sense to you to make that kind of an investment in an event like that?
Yeah, no, I don't fully grasp it quite yet either. You know, you would think maybe there's a streaming partner announcement coming where it can be broadcasted globally. But again, I don't understand how it all of a sudden makes people from around the world who weren't interested in college basketball before suddenly interested. However, it remains to be seen. You know, ESPN certainly won't be involved, because at least I would be shocked if they were, because they've actually stepped all over ESPN toes by bringing these teams in. These are teams that would traditionally be playing most likely in one of the ESPN broadcasted events. And so they basically, and some were, of course. So they've purged away ESPN's best brands. And so this is really kind of a little underbelly war starting. So we'll see how it plays out.
And to Briggs's question there, it brings up a great point, because it's a difficult time to put sports on, whether it's streaming or on the TV. Thanksgiving is known for football, whether it's, you know, the biggest NFL right. games. They're putting it on Christmas Day now. They're going Christmas Eve. College football's got some, you know, they got their some of their biggest rivalries around Thanksgiving. Then you go towards the holidays, they got some of their biggest bowl games. The NBA wants to start their Christmas, you know, their big hoopla Christmas. So it's a difficult time to get the sports viewers' attention, especially when you're not talking about diehard college basketball fans that usually jump in after the Super Bowl, after college football. It'll be interesting to see if they get enough eyeballs to warrant $10 million into these tournaments.
Yeah, excellent point. That's been one of the other topics heavily discussed on some of the folks that are kind of betting against this never having a chance. So again, so much of this remains to be seen. Obviously, this got signed off at very high levels to be able to finance it, but there's also a chance it falls on its face too. So it's extremely fascinating from where I'm sitting.
Yeah, this is going to be really interesting to find, not only see what happens this year, but I think it's something we've got to see how this plays out over several years.
Yeah,
And
possibly.
because there, I think that there may be a lot more money for college basketball than it's been bringing in right now also. I think there may be a basis for all this, and that maybe the NCAA has kind of been suppressing some of the money for a long time. And
Yes, that's a good. I mean, this is a
that's
whole
kind of what
other
it's
discussion.
about.
Yeah,
Yep.
college basketball has been poorly monetized. It could be monetized better. I just think that this is too far at the other end of the pool. $10 million for an early season tournament. That is over the moon.
Right, it's over the moon for us, but if it is truly all coming from golf money, like you and I know that takes 20 seconds of turning on a machine, and there's your 10 million. But yeah, like yeah, it's still got to be sustainable. They still have to have a way to make revenue, and
And if they
that's the
want to send
interesting
10
part.
million to Hoops HD for that we could upgrade our
Yeah.
facilities, we'll be happy to take it too.
We got to do an on-site. We got to
Yeah,
do an on-site visit, Chad. Let's
but
do
I'm afraid they'll upgrade the
it.
talent.
As long as they get rid of the puppet, I'm happy. But,
Hey, if you give me $10 million, I'll go away.
we'll have to think about that one.
Yeah.
Joby, let me go back to you because you had mentioned some of the realignment very briefly. I said we get back to that, and that is one of the biggest stories as we head into next season is obviously the death of the Pac-12 conference for those teams: Arizona State, Colorado, Utah going to the Big 12. Four more: Oregon, UCLA, USC, Washington off to the Big 10. ACC gets the leftovers with Cal and Stanford along with SMU. Remaining two teams, Oregon State and Washington State, are going off to the West Coast Conference for the time being, although maybe since they still own the Pac-12 rights, they may try to reform something in the future. The other big move, of course, Oklahoma and Texas from the Big 12 over to the SEC. And some smaller moves also, but those are the big ones everyone's going to be talking about
Well,
this
and
season.
I think, Chad, you hit the big component, obviously, with Pac-12. It's interesting the priorities in question. The Big Ten grabbed the biggest football name, without that. USC, UCLA, these are football schools, first and
If you
foremost.
put aside the
Big
Oklahoma
markets.
Texas move, I think you're right.
Yeah. Putting
Right.
aside
Big
the Oklahoma
markets.
Texas move, which is not the Pac-12 move, but yeah.
Yes. I'm saying the poaching of the
Recent.
Pac-12.
Right.
Big Ten got that. Give the Big 12 credit. Wow, what basketball did they get? My goodness. We all know Arizona, and I think Colorado's program, I mean, Rocco knows better than me. I think Colorado's program has some upside, and Utah's doing okay. And there was a Hurley involved.
Wrong one, but
But the Big 12 is going to become an even bigger basketball conference if because of the joining of Arizona. I don't think Oklahoma and Texas are very good programs. Arizona's elite. It's one of the top five, year in, year out, and they get to join Kansas. Wow, that's just going to be fun. So it's very interesting. Of course, the ACC. I'll just lay my own opinion on. I think it was done to block the conference from imploding because I think they were getting close to a number of votes to be able to have a majority that would leave and fight the grant of rights. And with Stanford, Cal, SMU's not even getting money from the conference for 7 years.
Crazy.
They basically say, just get us, which is actually probably a good move by
They're
SMU.
gonna
Still a
make more
good
money that
option.
way, so they're
They're
gonna make
going to
more
have
money.
them
It's
do
a good
NIL like
move.
the old days.
Yeah.
I mean,
Good
it's like
move.
crazy. So and the Dallas market, they're gonna. Yeah, I think this is actually a good move for both in a way in the short term. Long term, it will build as you get closer to the deadline of the grant of rights. People will be willing because the penalties won't be as much. Will be willing to press their luck in court. I think they probably. From what I understand, there is a reasonable chance of success, but it is far from guaranteed. So that's why people don't risk it. So, though Florida State is trying, that this was about keeping the band together as long as they can before the North Carolinas and the Florida States and, and even down to the Virginias and Georgia Techs and Miamis, who are attractive, you know, that's Virginia Tech and those like that. That's what that kept that for. But I give the Big Ten. It's a shame the Pac-12 is gone. But
yes,
and I, in my final, I'll have a different thing to say with the developments in my final thought.
Well, Griggs, there also was, aside from the movement in the major conferences, we'll give the under the radar conferences a quick shout out here for a second. The Northeast Conference did lose two teams, Merrimack and Sacred Heart. Gained two and replaced them. Chicago State coming over from the Independents and Mercyhurst, one of two new teams we're going to have welcome to D1 next year, joining our favorite conference there, the Northeast. But the other, also West Georgia, I'll throw this out there, they're going to be new to D1 as well. They're joining the A-Sun Conference. But the WAC Conference is the conference that may be the one that loses out at the end of all of this. They're losing two teams this year in SFA and UTRGV are going over to the Southland.
Next year, where they just came from.
Right. And next year, and that's not the last, that's not the first team that went from the WAC and then from Southland WAC and then back to Southland. Lamar's done it.
Oral Roberts sort of did it, although not to the WAC.
But on top of that, next year, the WAC is already slated to lose Grand Canyon and Seattle off to the West Coast Conference as well. And the WAC doesn't have replacements lined up. And this is the conference that may, that looks like it's taken the brunt of everything, as it's done a few times in the past with realignments, I think.
Yeah, it's, I remember when the WAC was in the discussion as being like a top level conference in both football and basketball, especially basketball. Utah, the Utes, the year they were in the national championship game and almost won it, they were a WAC team. They had multiple top 25 teams. I've loved the WAC, even, you know, under its current format and some of its recent formats. And I'm starting to think about that as well. It's like, is it going to survive or are we going to be down to just 30 conferences? And I don't understand some of these moves. I didn't quite understand going from the Southland to the WAC, but I thought it was a decent move and I thought it strengthened the conference and was a good move. Yeah. But then why are they jumping ship to go back to the Southland? I just didn't think the West Coast was ever going to take Seattle, largely because of Gonzaga. I just didn't think it was going to happen, but it did. Is it going to be there in another year or two?
I just thought there, Ty, to remind me, one other move this year also is Kennesaw is moving from the A-Sun to Conference USA. That's a football move. Sorry, Rocco, mm-hmm. You were going to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to realignment all over history, the WAC has stood for Wild American Cheap Shots. I think here we are again. It's like round five. But no, I think to your question, Griggs, I just wanted to give you a 2 cents on it. Yeah. You know, the idea of the WAC to begin with to take these Texas schools largely was all about football. And their promise to these teams was that we will be FBS by X year. Well, once a couple seasons went by, your Stephen F. Austins, your UTRGVs, your Lamar bailed very early. So did Incarnate
Houston
Word.
State. Very good.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good.
Yeah, it's very good football program, and they've made the jump to SUSA, as did New Mexico State. But like, that was the reason all of them came together. And as soon as the WAC did that A-Sun Alliance for football, which I think there's five teams in each. All these teams from Texas are looking at each other like, why don't we just play in the Southland? Because these A-Sun schools are not going to move up anytime soon. So we basically just wasted 4 or 5 years without getting anything we were promised from football. And we're Texas schools, and football always comes first. And that's why you'll see Abilene Christian at great risk, along with Tarleton at great risk, heading into next year. And UT Arlington on top of that. Mm-hmm.
To see if they how long they stay in the WAC and whether they're going off to the Southland as well. Tytel, even though we are in the off season, there is some basketball going on right now and a lot more starting the next week. The TBT is gone right now and the Olympics are starting next week. And so we're going to see some names and a chance to actually watch our sport get played in a different venue.
Yes, quick notes on each. TBT has eight teams already in their Sweet 16 with eight more to go in the days ahead. couple individual performances of note so far. If you look at TakeOver BC, you got AJ English, who was a three-time first-team all-conference player at Iona. He's averaging 27 points a game in his team's two wins. And his teammate Bryson Gresham has only missed one shot so far after shooting 64% from the field during his three-college career at UMass Houston and Texas Southern. As far as the Olympics, several players to keep an eye on. Three off the top of my head, Jimmer Fredette. He was National Player of the Year at BYU in 2011. He's playing not for the Olympic five-on-five team, but for the first-ever three-on-three team. Igor Milicic Jr. averaged 13-9 for Charlotte last year. He's a Serbian forward. He actually transferred to Tennessee last May, so we'll see if he can get some momentum going into SEC play this fall. And, of course, Chase Buttinger, the 6'7 forward from Arizona, where he was a two-time all-conference player who scored 17 points a game, shot 38% from behind the arc. And, of course, he'll be playing on the beach volleyball team.
Oh, the beach volleyball team. There yeah. we go. we're not going to have any Caitlin Clark on the women's team unless something has changed there. Which
don't believe so.
No. I don't believe it has changed. Sorry, Griggs, you had more thoughts?
Oh, no, that was perfect.
Oh, okay. That goes through most of my list. Have I missed anything, first of all, that we wanted to discuss?
Let's see. Not that's really worth discussing. I'm trying to think of what are some.
Why don't I move to final thoughts then, Griggs?
Okay, sure.
Let's do it for each of you. Any other final thoughts you have on anything we've discussed, on anything else that's going on in the off season, on anything else you want to bring out at all? Dorman, let me start with you.
I'll go to something I brought up on the show before. We're really going to find out how this travel situation happens here. Because like I've said, football is a different animal. You have 5, 6, max 7 road games. That's one night trip. You can leave on Friday. You'll be back on Saturday after the game. The travel for the football teams is not a big deal to go for one night, two nights, and back. There's 6 road games max. But for the other sports, the men's diving, the girls' field hockey, the softball, the baseball, these teams traveling across the country to go play in conditions that the weather is so iffy to get in certain games, and the travel and the expense for these non-revenue sports will be real interesting to see how long this can actually last, because it's just really, really expensive. And to fly, you know, from coast to coast, and then you got to go. If you did it once or twice a year, I get it. But if you're in a conference with these teams across the country, that's a lot of traveling and big time expenses for schools that aren't making money in those sports. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out and see how long this can sustain itself.
You know what, Dorman, I got to respond here. I think one of the interesting things will be whether or not schools are looking at an athletic department globally where they can talk about that football and basketball money that they're making, or if they say, look at each sport individually and say, well, our baseball team's getting crushed. Our bowling team is getting crushed. So I think that may, because you need those revenue sports, are going to be the ones that have to carry the rest of these sports. And unfortunately,
as they always have.
We may also see schools start cutting sports that down. I know there's a minimum you have to have. The minimum you have to be D1, but.
Yeah, it's 13 with football, 16 without. And right. That's more than you think. It's.
And it would be a shame to cut these sports when, if you could play your conference regionally and take buses and short flights, and the sport could probably sustain itself.
Mm-hmm. Joby.
Yeah, excellent point, Dorman. Men's non-revenue in particular, because Title IX will protect the women, I think, to a degree. But men's, you will not have men's track. It's something as basic as men's track is, and even wrestling is in big trouble. I am also going to reference the consolidation of conferences, but. This is something for John and Rocco and those interested in bracketology. So you might have seen on the website, the J&G has at least a preliminary seed list out based on preseason bias. Yeah, and so we thought it'd be fun to bracket it up. Oh, my goodness. When you remove the Pac-12 and put those teams like an Arizona in the Big 12, as I mentioned earlier, or in Oregon, who might be good enough to make the field, UCLA. The bracketing rules get really tough really fast. and so you're talking with these 18-team conferences. It is not outrageous to say every one of them gets 6 to 7 among the four. You're still left with, you know, you're still left at that point with 12 at-larges, 13 at-larges, given that the Pac-12 will be giving away its champion to an enlarged spot. And so you really will see these the consolidation of bids in these conferences for the most part, even with the changes we mentioned, even with new teams coming in. And that the it'll be very interesting to see from a technical purpose how quickly, for instance, Big 12 teams in particular, will have to avoid various regions. You will see rematches almost for sure of conference teams in the second round that played only once during the year. It's going to happen. It physically has to happen. And so it's going to blow people. For the people who do this, like Titel, Rocco, myself, it's going to be just, it's going to be add a whole new layer of the science into play.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to make some of the formulas a little more complicated, a lot harder to build some of these brackets probably, but Slika.
Well, I'd like to mention a couple of ticket offices. First, my condolences to the Fifth Third Arena ticket office because they had hosted the TBT regional that included both Nasty Natty and Zip Amuth, Whipshart, Xavier, and UC alumni. Good luck selling tickets with both teams losing in the first round of that one. But on a slightly happier note, I would like to mention the Dayton ticket office. Probably going to be selling more tickets on the news that there will be a notable charity exhibition coming up in either late October or early November.
October 21st.
Where Xavier and Dayton will have their first matchup since the 2015 Advocare Invitational Championship. So this one going to be played at UD Arena. It's going to be the same charitable foundation where Dayton and Ohio State met last year, where the Buckeyes ended up beating the Flyers. So it'll be interesting to see these two teams facing off for the first time in a decade.
Well, let's see after this, start next year, let's keep playing this and let's play it as a regular season game as opposed to an exhibition. There's no reason these two teams are not playing regularly. It's
I know.
A little ridiculous. Titel.
So I usually like to do a basketball-related final thought with a screenshot, but as July 22nd is a special day in the Titel family household, I would just like to wish my mother a happy birthday, even though she never, ever, ever watches our podcast.
Oh, yes, happy birthday to John's mother who's not watching. But Rocco.
Happy birthday
to
Mother
Titel. That was beautiful,
John.
Well, great set of it.
If she's ever going to watch an episode, today's the day.
Yeah, so happy birthday.
Yes. I'll try to go quick. I had a few leftover notes. First of all, in the Olympics, a guy who was born in the same town where I'm from, played for Washington State, had a four-year career, all Pac-12 guy, and started a pro career in Japan the last 5 years and gained Japanese residency. Stands out like a sore thumb in the Japan team picture, but congrats to Josh Hawkinson. Josh Hawkinson from Washington State, not only on the Japanese team, but a dominant force. I think he had a really good game in the exhibition scrimmage or whatever they did against the U.S. So Josh will be playing for Team Japan. Got my eye on him. Quick note on the realignment teams from the former Pac-12. I believe this to be true for both the ACC and Cal and Stanford, which is where I got the information, but also with the Big Ten for Washington, Oregon, and the LA schools. They have kind of narrowed it down, at least here in men's and women's basketball, to 4 trips a year. So that's the magic number. They'll be traveling in packs of 2 because their 5th trip will be against each other. So at least in the Big Ten, it will be. So after talking with Cal and Stanford, they said they only have 4 total trips they'll be on. So maybe they have to do a couple 3 packs. But that's one of their ways to mitigate travel, at least in basketball. And then also with the WAB, final thought, I would say, you know, I was one of the only people out there that really stuck my neck on the line and had Michigan State out of the field. Of course, I was wrong there, but I was also I made up for it with my Virginia choice. You're welcome, Joby, to make it in, regardless if you agree with that or not. But the WAB would have been on my side, as the WAB says that Michigan State clearly should have been out, let alone be a 9 seed, which is what they, I believe, were rewarded, or an 8 seed. So I thought that was interesting. And also, St. John's would have been much further out than they were. I think they're one of the first few teams out, according to the committee. And I also think Texas would have been a lot lower on the seed list, which another, just a couple other reasons to support the WAB if you're on our side on those three evaluations from last season.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Griggs, you want to finish the show out?
Yeah. John Stalika sort of mentioned charity games. I'm glad that we're seeing this. Kansas and Missouri was initially a charity game. And I think that you have to go through a lot with the other school to get the NCAA to sign off on that. In fact, I wish they were a little more or a little less stringent, because I think these are great events. I think it's better for the players. I think it's better for the fans. And I certainly think it's great for the charity. So hopefully we can get some more compelling charity early season game. I mean, you know, last year we had Purdue and Arkansas, and that was a lot of fun. I had a few other thoughts, but I know we're running out of time, so I'll just close by wishing John Tytel's mother a happy birthday.
She's watching.
Happy birthday. Yeah. Anyone else's birthday today, also happy birthday right. to you. But I do want to take this chance to thank everybody for joining us. On behalf of David Griggs and David Dorman, my side's up here. You guys did move around from where you were at the start of the show. John Tytel's now in the center square. John Sleek and Rocco Miller. Check him out at bracketeer.org as well. Joby Fortz is down at the bottom. I'm Chad Sherwood. We're going to try to come back again in August as opposed to waiting 2 months for our next show. Keep an eye on the website. Lots of great content going up there. Lots of interviews that Tytel's been doing in relation to TBT and Olympic players and the like. But on that note, take care, everybody. We'll talk to you again real soon.